So I'm here to give, in fact, three lectures, two today and one tomorrow. And the lectures will be mainly on the blackboard, but I will complement them a bit with some slides. And I will keep this, I have to keep this screen there, so I will use the blackboards on the left and the right. So today, the first lecture is going to start. So these are basic lectures, in fact, on gravitational waves. And the first one is going to discuss the linearization of Einstein equations. And we will derive the equation for propagation of gravitational waves. And we will put it in a very simple form using a particular gauge. And this will be the transverse traceless gauge in the Lorentz gauge, in fact. And then I would like to discuss the interaction of gravitational waves with free falling particle, test particle, because I want to show you which one, some of the key ideas that underlie the current gravitational wave detectors. That maybe you, I don't know how many of you are familiar with that, but there are now detectors that are operating in the US and also in Europe. They are taking data. So I want to show you what are the ideas that underlie, in fact, the functioning of these detectors. And in the second lecture this morning, I'm going to discuss the fact that gravitational waves are really physical waves. They carry off energy and angular momentum, linear momentum from the source. And we are going to briefly discuss also the so-called wave generation in Einstein theory and derive the so-called quadruple formula. And then, because of lack of time, having only three lectures, I will focus more on one of the most promising sources, which are the binary black holes or binary neutron star or neutron star neutron star systems. And we are going to discuss more in detail which kind of system we can get from this, which kind of waves are emitted from binary systems. And then tomorrow we will continue with binary black hole systems. And I want to show you what is the current status of both analytical and numerical modeling, because today we have also the possibility of simulating a binary black hole merger with a computer. And then, if I arrive at that point, I will briefly review other sources like pulsars, supernovae, and gravitational waves from the early universe. So please, if you have any question, stop me during the lecture. And I put on the web also some references, in particular also some chapter that you can follow from that refer to the lecture I'm going to give. And there is also a proceeding that you can use, which is on the web, that I wrote a few years ago on the lectures that I gave at Lesouches, so which actually are going to be very similar to the one that I give here, although there I had 5 hours, so it's going to be more detailed, okay? The proceeding that you find on the web. Okay, so let me start. Maybe I should. So, as I said, I will start from the linearization of Einstein equations. And just to give you. So some notations. I'm going to indicate with eta mu nu the flat metric, and I'm using the signature minus plus plus plus. I will indicate with nu and nu the Greek indices that go between 1 and 3, and with I and j the Latin indices that cover the space like indices 1, 3. So the Einstein action S E is the integral of d 4x r the square root of minus g. And so the generic metric I will indicate with g mu nu. And the g is just the determinant of the metric. And in my notation, the curvature tensor r nu nu rho sigma is going to be the derivative with respect to rho of gamma mu sigma nu minus the derivative with respect to sigma of gamma nu rho nu plus gamma lambda rho nu gamma mu sigma nu, sorry, lambda, minus gamma lambda sigma nu gamma lambda mu rho. Of course, on the blackboard, I'm not going to do all the steps because there is no space to do that, but I will just show you the main steps to get the linearized equations. The gamma is the connection, the affine connection. So let me write here, I think you can still read this part. Gamma mu mu rho is going to be 1 half g mu lambda, the derivative with respect to rho of g lambda nu plus the derivative with respect to mu of g lambda rho minus the derivative with respect to lambda of g mu rho. So these are going to be the building blocks. Also, in my notation, let me write here the Ricci tensor, R mu mu, is obtained by contracting the first with the third indices of the Riemann of the curvature tensor, and then the Ricci scalar is obtained by contracting R mu mu with the G mu mu. Okay, and this is the one that stays. This, I'm in trouble. I should have used this one as first, maybe. okay, so let me use for the moment this one. So the energy momentum tensor of matter, defined by taking the variation of the matter action with respect to g mu mu, you have d, the integral d4x, the square root of minus g, g mu mu, variation of g mu mu. And by taking the variation of the action I wrote there, the Hilbert-Einstein action, and this action here, you can derive what are called the Einstein equation, g mu mu equal to r mu mu minus 1 half g mu mu r equal to 8 pi capital G, the Newton constant, divided by c to the 4 g mu mu. Okay, so if you consider the fact that mu and nu run between 0 and 4, these are in principle 16 differential equations. However, if you take into account the symmetry of the tensor, the fact that, these are symmetric with respect to mu and nu, they reduce, in fact, to 10 equations. And then we will see in a moment how these 10 equations can be even reduced to a smaller number. And at the end, we will arrive when we will, in fact, linearize the equation to only 2 degrees of freedom, that are the one carried by the gravitational wave. So these equations are nonlinear because R mu nu here, as I wrote there, they depend on product of this gamma, which depends on the G. So they are going to be nonlinear equations. But these equations are well posed in the sense that if you fix some initial conditions, then you can find a solution at a later time. And in fact, we will see at some point as an example the fact that today, in fact, you can solve this equation numerically if you put as initial condition the condition of 2 black holes, for example, that are quite separated. And then you find that by solving this equation numerically, for example, with a computer, you can study the evolution and then the merger and the formation of a new black hole in the case of a binary system. Now, general relativity is, as you know, invariant under generic coordinate transformations. Let's say x mu that goes to x prime mu, under which the metric transforms in a certain way. The new metric, g prime mu mu, is going to be the derivative of x rho under this transformation x prime mu, the derivative of x sigma with respect to x prime mu g rho sigma. This is true in general. Now, for what concerns us, I'm going to assume that there is a reference frame in which I can write the metric g mu nu like eta mu nu plus h mu nu, with this h mu nu much smaller than 1. And for the lecture today, I'm going to linearize with respect to a flat spacetime, but we will see the lecture on at 11 that actually you can also write an equation like this when you have a background which is not necessarily flat, but you have to have some criteria because you have to have a way of separating what is the gravitational wave, what you call the perturbation, with respect to what you have, your space-time. You have to have a clean way of separating the two. In flat space-time, this is quite clear because flat space-time, you know, you have zero curvature. And so the gravitational wave will be some ripple on your flat space-time. In the case in which this space-time is curved, it's a little bit more complicated, but not much. Okay, so what I'm saying is that I'm going to basically write the metric as flat plus a perturbation. And as you can imagine, if you do this, if there is a frame in which I can do this separation, this breaks the big group of coordinate of the fact that the theory is invariant under any coordinate transformation of this type. However, there is a portion of this coordinate transformation for which the theory is still invariant. For example, you can consider transformation for which sin x mu, the coordinate x mu, goes to x mu plus sin mu. Okay? And if you impose that the derivative of this sin mu is also much smaller than 1, you can show that linearized theory is still invariant under this subgroup, if you want, of the big group of coordinate transformations. And in fact, you can follow again that proceeding to see the details. But what happens is that if you write, if you do this transformation here, you can show that you will end up with a new g mu nu prime, which is going to be h prime mu nu plus eta mu nu, okay? Where this h prime mu nu, actually, I should start erasing here. Well, this h prime mu nu is just h mu nu minus the derivative of mu psi mu minus the derivative with respect to mu of psi mu. By the way, I forgot to say, so the partial derivative like this are just common derivative, and when I will use sometime covariant derivative, I will put a semicolon, okay? Okay, so you can also show that linearized, when you do this, so you assume that there is a frame in which you can do this separation, and the theory is still invariant, linearized theory under this transformation here. You can also show that the theory is going to be invariant under the Poincaré group. Lorentz transformation plus translations. Well, actually, Lorentz transformation plus translation, I mean, like the Poincaré group, well, so Poincaré group plus these are the two symmetry of the linearized theory. Okay, so now I want to derive a wave equation using this decomposition here. And here I, okay, so here actually I can do now this. And the first thing to notice is that, so I want to now use that assumption that G mu mu is theta mu mu plus H mu mu, and I want to compute at the end the various quantities here that enter in the Einstein equation. So I want to rewrite the Einstein equation R mu mu minus 1 half G mu mu R in a much simpler form using that answers. And to do that, I need to compute R mu mu and then R. So, and R mu mu, you compute it from this, the curvature tensor here. And so how do you do that? Well, first of all, let's notice that if I want to work just at linear order in H, these terms here are going to be higher order because they will always contain an H square. The reason is because the gamma is going to be proportional to H. Okay, because eta mu mu is a flat metric, so every time you take a derivative of the flat metric, it's going to be zero here. So the gamma is going to be proportional to H, or derivative of H. And so when you compute the curvature tensor, these terms here are going to be higher order terms, proportional to H squared. And so the only term I have to care about are these terms here. Okay, so if you go through the calculation, which I'm not going to do here, but you will find in the notes, the result is the following. You find that, for example, the curvature tensor, R mu nu rho sigma, is going to be 1 half. The derivative with respect to rho and the index n, mu, sorry, of H mu sigma. Then you have the derivative with respect to sigma and mu of H mu rho minus the derivative with respect to rho and mu of H mu sigma minus the derivative with respect to sigma and mu of H mu rho. It's a little bit long calculation, but not much, in fact. Now, it is straightforward to show that the curvature tensor is invariant under the transformation. Basically, we said that under the transformation, the Fourier transformation x mu plus psi mu, H was varying in that way that I wrote there. And the Riemann, the curvature tensor is invariant, in fact, under this transformation. So the Riemann tensor, the linearized Riemann tensor, is invariant under this transformation. So there is a very interesting analogy between linearized gravity and electromagnetic theory, electrodynamics, in fact, because let's say in linearized gravity and electrodynamics, the role that here is played by H mu nu is played in electrodynamics by the field vector A nu, the vector potential A nu. There is a gauge transformation in electrodynamics which sends A nu to A nu minus the nu lambda, S mu, and F mu nu, which is the derivative with respect to mu of A nu minus the derivative with respect to mu of A nu, is going to be invariant under this gauge transformation. And in the same way here, you have, if you want, this, which would replace this one. And here, the role played by F mu nu is going to be played by the curvature tensor, which in fact is going to be invariant under this transformation here. Okay? So there is analogy, but only, notice, at linear order. In fact, when you go at higher order and start including the h squared term, h cubed term, etc. Of course, the theory are very different because electrodynamics are no non-linearities. Okay, so well, this is the first step. So now, in order to derive, where I wrote the, okay, I cancel it, the Einstein equation. So we need to compute, as I said, the R mu nu starting from this one. Now, it is convenient to do that, not to work with H, but to work with another quantity, which is called, I think at this point I can erase this part, which is called the trace reverse tensor. It's a function of H, but it allows to simplify the equations considerably. I'm going. Actually, can I erase this information? Because I prefer to start with this. Can I erase this? No, I guess everybody has taken it. So first of all, since we are going to work at linear order in H, I can, you know that in general relativity you can raise and lower the indices with the metric g nu nu, but if I have, for example, H nu beta, this one is just given by eta nu alpha, H alpha beta. In principle, you have to put g here, but because I'm going to get, I'm going to disregard all terms that are proportional to h squared, I can just replace g with eta. So you can lower and raise indices just with eta. Moreover, I'm going to indicate with h the trace of this tensor, h nu nu. And now I introduce a new tensor, h bar, I'm going to call it nu nu, which is equal to h mu nu minus 1 half eta mu nu h, where h is the trace of h. And the reason why this is called in fact the trace reverse tensor, the reason why it's called like that is because if you compute the trace of it, this is going to be minus h. Okay, you can prove it very easily. Okay, so the reason why it's convenient to work with this tensor is because if you plug in the Riemann tensor the a instead of h, h bar, and then you compute the Ricci tensor and then r, you are going to find, or maybe I can write, you are going to find that the Einstein equation reduced to this simple form. So if you define d rho equal to the box, you have that the box of h bar nu rho plus eta nu sigma d rho d lambda h bar rho lambda minus d rho d nu h bar rho sigma plus minus d rho d sigma h bar rho nu plus order h square is going to be minus 16 pi g minimum. So basically, to get this, you have to do some calculation, okay? Starting from the fact that you trade H with H bar, you plug in the Riemann tensor, you compute the Ricci tensor, etc., and the Ricci scala, and at the end you end up with this equation, which is not still as some terms that we would like to get rid of them, but it's much more simpler, okay? In fact, it is very simple to get rid of these three terms here if you introduce the so-called Lorentz gauge. So if you assume that this condition is satisfied, so the derivative with respect to nu of h bar mu nu is equal to zero. Since you can exchange the derivative, the order of the derivative, because these are just normal derivatives, you can see immediately that these three terms, you can put them to zero. And so at linear order in h, you get that the box of this field, h bar and mu rho, is going to be equal to, besides this coefficient in front, just proportional to the energy momentum tensor of the matter. Okay? And this again resembles very much the equation that you get in electromagnetic theory again, if you are using the Lorentz gauge. By the way, this Lorentz, not that there is no T here, is not the same Lorentz. Okay, although sometimes you find it in some books, but actually it's not the same Lorentz, it's another Lorentz. okay, so, well, that's a first step. So you get some kind of wave equation. In fact, if you are very far from the source, suppose that you are very far from the source, where there is no energy momentum tensor, then your equation becomes the box on H mu equal to zero with the gauge, the Lorentz gauge, which is this one. If you want, this could be the propagation equation in vacuum. Okay? So I want now actually to go further and even reduce more this equation by using a freedom, which is there in the Lorentz gauge. The Lorentz gauge is not unique. I can still do a coordinate transformation of the kind x mu that goes in x mu plus psi mu, and impose that with the condition that the box on psi mu is equal to zero, and I'm still in the Lorentz gauge. So I have this extra freedom, basically. And I want to use this to reduce the number of degrees of freedom in h bar mu nu to only two. And this will be the two polarization of the gravitational wave. In fact, the gravitational wave is a spin two particle. Okay, so let's see a moment this. Are there any questions, by the way? Yes?
For gravitational waves in a vacuum.
Yes.
Does that mean that the gravitational waves themselves don't give a contribution to the energy momentum tensor?
No, they will. In fact, at the linearized theory, if you want, you are assuming that there is no back action.
So it's higher order?
Yes, it will be higher order. In fact, we will derive, I think, in the next lecture, what we call the effective energy momentum tensor of a gravitational wave, which is proportional to, is quadratic in the derivative of H. Okay. So I want to go now in the so-called transverse traceless gauge. And so I wrote on the other side of the blackboard how H mu nu varies if I do a coordinate transformation, which I still can do, as I said, inside the Lorentz gauge. But because I'm working here with the field H bar, I want to write down how H bar mu nu varies under that coordinate transformation. So this is going to be H mu nu minus the derivative with respect to mu of psi mu, derivative with respect to psi mu of psi mu as H mu nu, but there is an extra term, which is eta mu nu, zero psi rho. Okay, so now with a condition that, that if I call this if I call all this, okay, psi mu nu, it satisfies this condition here. And so what I'm going to do is basically I use the this psi mu nu, I have the freedom of choosing the components of it, because this is a coordinate transformation that I can always apply. And so what you can show is that you can choose basically psi mu nu in such a way that you can subtract to h bar mu nu four of the six components. So for example, you can show that you can put the h 0 0 equal to 0, the h 0 I equal to 0, and the trace HII equal to 0, so that the Lorentz gauge, in fact, tells you that the derivative with respect to I of HIJ, which now are the only components which are different from 0, because I put 0, 0 to 0, and 0I to 0, are going to be satisfy this equation here. And H, I, J are going to be different from zero. Okay? And in fact, this equation here tells you that the gravitational waves are going to be transverse to the direction of propagation, because if Ni is the vector in the direction of propagation, this equation is just Ni Hij equal to 0. Okay. And in fact, without losing generality, you can assume a gravitational wave that goes in the z direction, for example, and oscillates. And you can write that Hij transverse traceless. Transverse traceless means this operation that I'm doing here, okay, which reduces the number of the isofield just to 2, is going to be H plus H cross minus H plus 0, 0, 0, 0, 0. And for example, if it is oscillating with a certain frequency, you can write also minus Z over C. So this would be, for example, the case in which the gravitational wave is propagating along the Z direction, and H plus and H cross, which have to satisfy this condition that this is equal to this and this is minus this because of the traceless, has that form there. Okay, so you can also prove that, I don't know how many of you are familiar with what we call the elicity state. In particle physics, this is used in the projection of the spin in the direction of the angular momentum, total angular momentum, but then it's actually the direction of this. It's the projection of the total angular momentum in the direction of propagation. And then because J is L plus S, is actually the projection of the spin in the direction of propagation. And here you can show that the combination of H plus and H cross, H plus plus minus I H cross, in fact, is an elicity state, and the elicity is 2. You can prove this if you want. It's an exercise. It's very simple. You have just to see how they transform under rotation, because you have to do a rotation around the direction of propagation. Okay, so now the rest of the lecture, I want to cover another topic, which is how the gravitational waves interact with the particles that are free falling. And this is very important because one of the main gravitational wave detectors that are now operating are so-called laser interferometers, where you have mirrors hung by wires. And the mirrors, in fact, as we will see, you can consider them like free, because the frequency of oscillation is much smaller than the frequency of the gravitational wave. And so under the effect of the gravitational wave, these mirrors are like free particles. And by by monitoring, in fact, the relative displacement of or the proper distance between these two mirrors, that's the way in which we will detect gravitational waves. So you don't collect a flux of gravitons. It's not like when you want to observe something in electromagnetic astronomy, where you collect photons. It's not the same principle that we use for detecting gravitational waves. We really see how we really detect the way in which gravitational waves move particles around, in this case, mirrors. So let's start that. And actually, I think I can use this one. And I want to start with a simple example, which is a Newtonian description. Of what we call tidal gravity. Before generalizing it to the relativistic case. So suppose that you have, this is something I'm sure you're familiar with. Suppose that you have two particles, A and B, that are moving in a gravitational field, which is inhomogeneous, could be the one of the Earth, for example. And suppose that at initial time, the two particles have the same velocity. They start with a certain velocity, and the velocity is the same. And so let's say that VA is equal to VB. By the way, I'm assuming here that this is just a Euclidean space, three-dimensional Euclidean space. There is no curved space. It's that the two particles are just falling in a Newtonian potential, which is inhomogeneous. Now, because the potential, the gravitational potential is inhomogeneous, although the two particles at the beginning have the same velocity, then as time passes, the velocity changes a bit, and so they acquire a different acceleration. And so if I introduce the Euclidean vector psi I, which is x ai minus x bi, I want to know how this vector changes all along the evolution. Okay? And so what is, for example, the time derivative of this vector? It's going to be the difference of the velocity of the two particles. And then if I take another time derivative, I get the acceleration. And you know what is the acceleration of each of them? Do you know? What would be the second time derivative of xi in a gravitational potential phi? Just from Newtonian. Okay, so it's going to be the derivative, the gradient of the potential, no? The derivative of phi with respect to xi in the position A minus plus the derivative of the potential with respect to xi in B. Okay. Now, I'm assuming actually that these two particles are quite close to each other. So psi is quite small. And so what I can do is to expand. For example, I can expand around B, or vice versa, I can expand around A. I can Taylor expand. And the result will be the following, that the second time derivative of the vector psi I is going to be minus, let me call it ij psi j. This tensor here, let's call it tensor, is the second derivative of psi with respect to xi xj. In an Euclidean space, by the way, I can raise and lower the indices I want because I'm in flat space time. And this tensor here is called the tidal gravity tensor. It's actually the tensor which is responsible of the tides on the Earth, okay, due to the moon or due to the sun, for example. It's because of the inhomogeneity of the gravitational field that you have this effect here, which is proportional to the second derivative of phi with respect to xi xj. So why I'm introducing this? I'm introducing this because, in fact, we will see in a moment, if we generalize this to general relativity, you will see that the role played by this tidal gravity tensor is going to be the Riemann, the curvature tensor. So this EIJ, the role will be played by the I naught naught J naught component of the Riemann of the curvature tensor. And in the case in which this curvature is due to a gravitational wave, because the gravitational wave means that you have some, in fact, curvature present, is going to be the second derivative, as we will see, of hij. So basically, the effect of a gravitational wave on particles that are just free falling in a gravitational field is to change the proper distance, in fact, as we will see, in time, because this will be a function of time of the two particles as they continue to free fall. Okay?
EIJ is proportional to R.
How this is proportional to this?
No, the first line. The first line?
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
Oh, because now I'm going to show you that by generalizing this equation into general relativity, and which means that if you study, for example, how if you have two geodesics and you study how the relative distance between the two geodesics vary in a curved space-time, then you find out a similar equation where this is going to, the role of AIJ is going to be played by some Riemann tensor, components of the Riemann tensor. I didn't prove it here, I'm just anticipating. Okay? So, in fact, let's a moment look at the. The relativistic generalization of what I said there, which I'm going to sketch because it will take too much time to go into the all the details. But as you know, in general relativity, a free falling particle follows a geodesic. And if you have a massive test particle in a curved background, the geodesic equation is going to be the following. The second derivative of x mu, which describes the particle trajectory with respect to tau, which is the proper time, plus you have the affine connection, gamma mu rho sigma, dx rho d tau, dx sigma in tau equal to zero. And in fact, if you are in flat space time, where the affine connection is zero, you get the equation for a geodesic, if you want, in flat space time, which says that the particle is either at rest or is moving with constant velocity. Okay? Now, to generalize what I did. What I did actually in the blackboard, in the piece of the blackboard which is behind it, I unfortunately I was yes. To the case of general relativity, what you have to do is that so suppose that one particle is following this word line here, and then you have another particle which is following another word line. Which is psi mu plus psi mu. And what you do is basically you write the equation, the analogous equation for this word line, and you Taylor expand again. Assuming that psi is small, you can Taylor expand with respect to that word line, okay? For example, this one here, around this one here. And the equation that you get is the following. Which again, I'm not assuming here that you know grasp all that is behind it because it needs some it will need some time to really derive it on the blackboard. So if you introduce this kind of derivative, which is the derivative with respect to u, where u is the velocity. Which is defined to be. Because I want to write it in a compact form, the derivative of psi mu with respect to tau plus gamma mu rho sigma psi rho. Okay? So this is just, if you want, take it as a definition. Then the equation that generalizes the Newtonian equation I wrote above is the following. You have twice this derivative along the word line of psi mu equal to minus r mu, mu rho sigma, and then is proportional to psi rho. No, this is proportional to psi rho as before it was. And then it's also, there are two terms here, the derivative of psi nu with respect to tau and the derivative of psi sigma with respect to tau, which is just the velocity u nu and u sigma. But it's not important here to see the details, but it's just that, so this would be the generalization of, in fact, this is called the equation of geodesic deviation, okay? And you see the role played by the Riemann curvature, Riemann tensor, sorry, here, which it's analogous to the role that the tidal gravity tensor was playing before. So in curved space time, in a flat space time, this is going to be zero. And in fact, the relative, you know, if you have two geodesic in flat space time, the distance between them is going to be preserved. I mean, doesn't vary in time, okay? They remain parallel to each other. But it's the presence of a curved space time that produces a deviation, in fact. And that is proportional to the Riemann tensor. Okay, so why all this is important for, again, gravitational waves? Well, the reason is because if now, we want to apply all this, want to use this, to the case in which you have the following situation. So suppose that So you have a particle here, A, and a particle here, B. And this is x, this is minus y, and this is time. So there were no gravitational waves, and there is no other force acting to the particle. The particle, the word line will be just, will just go up like this, no? A long time. They will not move, they will remain there, okay? I want to understand how, on the other hand, if there is a gravitational wave that passes through this system and interact with these free-falling particles here, how they are going to move with respect to each other. Okay? And what I need to do that is basically the equation of geodesic deviation. So we have just to basically now compute that equation in this particular situation, assuming that the Riemann tensor is, the presence of the Riemann tensor is due to a gravitational wave. Okay, so I think that this will be, in fact, the last thing I'm going to do. And again, I'm going to sketch it a little bit. So suppose I want to do this exercise, assuming that I'm an observer, which is free falling with respect to the particle A, which means that you know, you might know that in general relativity, you can always define in one position in space a so-called, can always reduce to a local inertial frame. In the sense, you can always impose that in this position A, the metric is flat, okay? And so in this, at the origin there, I'm assuming that the metric reduced to the Minkowski metric, and I'm assuming that B, it's also quite close, as I've been assuming until now, to A, okay? Xi here is quite small. So if I'm an observer that is free falling with respect to A, I can say that the metric around the A is just minus c square dt square plus dx square, flat metric. But of course, there are corrections that I'm not going to include, but they are going to be proportional to x square divided by the curvature radius. The curvature radius is proportional to some component of the Riemann tensor. Okay? So if the Riemann tensor is zero, the curvature radius is going to be infinity, and so this term is going to disappear. So this you can always do locally. You cannot do everywhere if you have a curved spacetime, but you can do it locally. Okay, so that's good. So now, if you take that equation there, and if you are in a free-falling frame, gamma is going, you can put the gamma to zero in a free-falling frame, not the derivative of the gamma, but the gamma. And if you compute that equation, assuming that this is the metric, and the gamma is zero, but not the derivative of the gamma, and that the particles here are initially at rest, which means that the vector u beta, which is the derivative of x beta with respect to tau, is going to be delta beta zero, because only the time component is different from zero because it's initially at rest. Then you find, magically, the following equation. Psi j, the second derivative of psi, which is the separation between the two particles, like that, with respect to tau square, is going to be minus r j 0 k 0 psi k. Actually, here I can put just time. Okay? So there are some details that you can find in the note, the proceeding that I, how to get actually this equation. There is also an exercise that I gave for this afternoon for you, where you can actually obtain the same result if you don't use this free falling frame here, but the so-called transverse traceless gauge, which is also another way of getting this result. So maybe you want to try to do it for this afternoon, okay? And you can then we can discuss together this afternoon the solution. And so this is what I had anticipated before. So basically, you see now that the tidal gravity tensor in this particular case is really this Rj0k0. Okay. Now the only thing we need to compute is this quantity. What is now this quantity for a gravitational wave? I told you at the very beginning that in linearized gravity, Riemann tensor is invariant under that coordinate transformation that I wrote on the blackboard. And so you can compute it, for example, we can apply that coordinate transformation to go to the transverse traceless gauge. You can always do that, okay? Because it remains the same, it's invariant. And so I can compute it directly in the transverse traceless gauge. And now I don't remember if it is on the blackboard. No. If you compute, well, let me write just one equation, which I think I erased, or maybe I never wrote, in fact. If you go back to your notes, I don't remember if I wrote the expression of R in terms of H bar. But if not, then you compute that in terms of H bar, and then you go to the transverse traceless gauge that we did, and then you find that this quantity is just minus one half H double dot TT JK. And so you plug it here, and you get one half H double dot JK. And this is the important equation. So it's the second time derivative of the gravitational wave that determines, in fact, how the distance, which, by the way, in this free falling frame, the proper distance coincides with the coordinate system, with the coordinate distance. Okay? So don't be confused by the fact that I'm talking about the coordinate system, the coordinate distance here, which in general relativity has not a lot of meaning because, in fact, it depends on the coordinates. But because I'm using the free falling frame, it coincides with the proper distance. So I can really promote this as the proper distance between the two particles, which is important because otherwise, if it were the coordinate system, the coordinate distance, it has not a lot of physical meaning, okay? So now, because of this way in which the relative proper distance between the two bodies can vary, you can in fact show, and I will conclude with that. I had just one plot. So suppose that you have. I want to show you this plot here. So suppose, in fact, that you have only the plus polarization, and which is propagating along a certain direction, and your HIJTT is going to be, for what we derived before, 1, 0, 0, minus 1. And then you have sine of omega t, for example. And suppose that the top there, you have a gravitational wave that propagates perpendicular to the screen. And you have a ring of particles all around each other, okay, that are in free fall. And as the gravitational wave oscillates, at the beginning, the circle remains the same, okay, because the amplitude of the wave is zero. Then when the amplitude is maximum, you have a squeezing in a certain direction and the stretching in the other direction. And then when the amplitude of the wave is zero again, you get again the ring of particles, and then it's squeezing the other direction, and then it goes back to the original one. And if the H cross would be different from zero instead of the H plus, you have the same kind of effect, but rotated by 45 degrees, because the two polarization, H plus and H cross, are in fact, you can go from one to the other by rotation of 45 degrees. So that's the effect on a ring of particles. And you can immediately imagine that if you have, actually, I have the program. So instead of having a ring of particles, you have, so this is a Fabry-Perot cavity, the two mirrors are here, another Fabry-Perot cavity, the two mirrors are here. And suppose that you are looking, you have threefold observer here at the beam splitter, and you want to monitor the proper, the variation of the proper distance between the mirrors, actually the difference between the proper distance between the two arm cavities. And under the effect of a gravitational wave, you have the same effect of squeezing and stretching. And this squeezing and stretching is what we monitor with the laser light. Okay? And, well, I think I have to stop. I have to stop, no? Yes. So we will continue at 11 anyway. Okay?